My name is Clark Murdoch. I'm the director of the Project on Nuclear Issues here at CSIS. One of our favorite events or series of events that we hold with respect to the Project on Nuclear Issues is Boney Debates the Issues. I'm very pleased to announce, first of all, that Chris Jones is the organizer. He's a research assistant here at Boney at CSIS and organizes these debates. We'll be holding a second event on 2 March. It'll be the day after the release of the Nuclear Posture Review. It will not be a debate in the way that we framed the debates, the series of debates that we had last year, but rather a panel where Ivan Ulrich and I are 2 of the panelists. We do not have the 3rd panelist for this discussion confirmed, but it's somebody to the right of me. And people do exist to the right of me on these issues as well. So we will be having another event on 2 March to talk about the Nuclear Posture Review. But tonight we have a debate that Chris Jones will moderate. Chris, if you would introduce people.
Hi, welcome, everyone, to the Boney Debates the Issues Heavyweight Championship.
Hey, I'll lose weight if I do.
The resolution for tonight's debate reads that further reductions in the U.S. nuclear arsenal are in the national security interest of the United States. Defending the affirmative of the resolution will be John Isaacs, who's the executive director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, and applause.
I can't have more applause than that.
And defending the negative side of the resolution will be Baker Spring, who's the FM Kirby Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. I'll talk quickly about the format for the debate. Basically, we're going to have each side, starting with the affirmative, provide an opening statement, ideally in the 5 to 7 minute range, which we're hoping we'll be able to enforce. And then after each side, we will have, when the negative concludes, the affirmative will go first, then the negative, then there will be a cross-examination period between the panelists, and then there will be, I will ask each of them an equal number of questions, then there will be 3-minute closing statements. We're hoping that will take about 40 minutes, and then we'll turn it open to the audience for questions that you may have. So we will lead it off with the affirmative opening statement from Mr. Isaacs.
Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this debate. This great hall has seen many debates, discussions, speeches, and I hope that tonight, after a few more hundreds or thousands of words are spoken, that we are able to find a pony amidst all the words. Oh, some understand. There's some mystified looks, too. And what the heck did I mean by that? I specialize in antiquated expressions. This is one that Ronald Reagan used at a press conference in the 80s, I guess it was, 70s, 80s. If you have Blackberries, you can Google expressions, find the pony. Now, back to the debate. I'm happy to debate such a knowledgeable and experienced opponent in Baker Spring. I commend him for devoting his life to issues in which he cares about very deeply, rather than to go on to richer rewards as a high-paid lobbyist somewhere in town. And in fact, this is his 20th anniversary of starting at Heritage Foundation, for which I salute him. But I have to say I did not come to praise Baker Spring, but rather to debate him. While we might agree on the threat posed to the American security in Washington, D.C. specifically by the recent snowstorms, that may be one of the few issues on which we agree tonight. And I'm sure, however, he would not agree with my new slogan, which is more snowplows, fewer nukes. My job tonight is to defend the proposition that further reductions in the nuclear arsenal are in the national security interest of the United States. And I start out with the number 23,000. 23,000. That's the number of nuclear weapons worldwide. Over 90% of which are in the hands of the United States and Russia. Now, in upholding the position that these numbers should be reduced, I stand here in the company of many others who also endorse nuclear reductions. For example, I stand here in the company of former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger. The congressionally mandated nuclear posture study which he co-chaired along with Secretary of Defense Perry, unanimously agreed that the moment appears ripe for renewal of arms control with Russia, and this bodes well for a continued reduction in the nuclear arsenal. The United States and Russia should pursue a step-by-step approach, which is exactly what is happening today. That same commission included a number of other important figures in the Republican establishment, including Keith Payne, James Woolsey, and Freddie Clay. I also stand this evening with former Secretaries of State Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, who agree with the same proposition that it's time to start reducing nuclear weapons. They, along with Secretary Perry and former Senator Sam Nunn, wrote in the Wall Street Journal January 15, 2008, quote, "There should be an agreement to undertake further substantial reductions in U.S. and Russian nuclear forces beyond those recorded in the U.S.-Russian Strategic Offensive Reductions Treaty." And perhaps most importantly for tonight, I stand in good company with the person who started this debate tonight, led off, and is the head of the Project of Nuclear Issues, Clark Murdoch, who, because one of the things I did before coming to the debate was listen to one of the previous debates, which included one Clark Murdoch, who said at the time he endorses dramatically lower nuclear weapons inventories for the United States of America. So clearly, in talking about nuclear reductions and its importance, I stand in very good company. Why do these distinguished figures, so many people from both parties and retired military as well, agree that further nuclear reductions are in the U.S. national security interest? They do so because the world has changed since Baker Springs started Heritage Foundation 20 years ago. There's a new bipartisan concession that the current nuclear status quo is no longer tenable. There's a new feeling that in the post 9/11 world, security will come from cooperative multilateral effort to reduce the nuclear threat. That the potential threat of nuclear weapons and materials to additional states and terrorists, as well as the continued dangers posed by existing nuclear arsenals, has put the world on the verge of a proliferation tipping point. And they also believe that a new arms reduction agreement is one of the many critical measures that will increase U.S. security, and strengthen efforts to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. Now, in my few minutes remaining, I'd like to add a couple more reasons for supporting nuclear reductions. Firstly, nuclear reductions codified in a new U.S.-Russian treaty will provide important limits and verification provisions that can help ensure a stable and predictable U.S.-Russian nuclear relationship. The clear alternative to new nuclear reductions negotiated between the United States and Russia is no treaty, no limits, and no verification provisions. Or even worse, as I think Baker Spring might agree, for himself at least, unilateral reductions. A new nuclear reductions treaty would give each side, Russia and the U.S., a measure of confidence that reduces the chances for misunderstanding and the worst-case scenario planning that traditionally countries engage in. START's monitoring verification provisions in the previous agreements have provided each side with important information on the size and location of each other's nuclear forces, and I believe the next treaty will as well. Second reason, U.S. and Russian nuclear reductions would reduce the risk of theft of weapons or materials used for nuclear terrorism. Nearly every national security expert today agrees that terrorist use of nuclear weapons is the greatest security threat to the United States. The best way to address this threat of nuclear terrorism is by securing vulnerable nuclear materials and verifiably reducing nuclear stockpiles. Remember that number 23,000, the total number of nuclear warheads worldwide, again more than 90% possessed by the United States and Russia. No other country possesses more than 300 nuclear weapons compared to the much larger arsenals of the United States and Russia. Designed for the Cold War, these nuclear arsenals are useless against current threats like terrorism, useless in Afghanistan, useless in Iraq, but vulnerable to theft. So I've explained why new nuclear reductions are good for U.S. national security. For all these reasons, the bipartisan consensus for new nuclear reductions, that the treaty will provide important limits and verification procedures, that a new nuclear reductions agreement will strengthen efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, that the treaty will reduce the risk of theft of weapons or nuclear materials by terrorists. For all these reasons, I sit before you tonight to say further reductions in the nuclear arsenal are in the national security interest of the United States of America. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'd like to echo John's comments about what a great pleasure it is for me to participate in this debate series. Clearly, nuclear issues have not, one thing we can agree on, I think, John, is that nuclear issues in the last decade or so haven't enjoyed the attention that they deserve, certainly from the Congress, maybe a lesser degree from the executive branch, but certainly in the public as a whole. So that anything that we can do with regard to educating the public with regard to these issues, I think, is a good endeavor and time well spent. I also thank you for your graciousness in acknowledging my years at Heritage. As I look at the debate topic here, I think it is important to point out that at least is the way that I interpret the mandate that I have here to negate the proposition about the reduction in the numbers of nuclear weapons is that it is not a question of whether under any imaginable circumstance, under any imaginable U.S. policy, that there couldn't be some reductions in either global or U.S. nuclear arsenals. The question is whether the time is ripe now and the circumstances are amenable to those reductions and U.S. policy is amenable to those reductions. My view is that, and it may be a minority view, but my view is that it's not. And it's not precisely for the same reason that John gave in terms of why he thought the time was ripe. That is that we are in a new circumstance. We are not dealing with the dynamic of the bilateral, bipolar, Cold War setting. So the question is do we have an overall strategic posture and, as a component of that, a nuclear posture that is really geared towards achieving stability, whether that be crisis stability or arms race stability, in this new setting? Well, what is the setting? The setting that we can reasonably expect, I think, is one of at least potential, if not real, nuclear multipolarity. It is a much more complex and dynamic setting. Doesn't carry quite the risks of global Armageddon that the U.S.-Soviet confrontation did, but nonetheless a very complex setting. I am not convinced that, whether it be in the younger Bush administration of the last few years or the current administration, that the pieces have been put in place that we really know what we're doing with regard to the potential for these kinds of reductions. I don't think that it's necessarily inappropriate to say, because of the numbers involved, that the process does begin with Russia and the United States. That may well be true. But I think that we need to take a step back and really take stock of the circumstances that we are in and the policies that are being pursued, particularly by the current administration, and see what they mean. I brought a chart with me that you can see there. And what that chart is about is three archetypal U.S. arms control policies pursued in an assumed setting of nuclear multipolarity. This one happened to be based on a greater Middle East setting with U.S. and Russian involvement overlaying that. And the three policies that were pursued were the ones basically of the current administration, stepping back from defensive options, pursuing nuclear disarmament, but in this setting where the nonproliferation problem is, to put it mildly, severe. The second is to take Cold War-style deterrence policy and apply that arms control lesson from the Cold War that looks at preserving retaliatory capacity. The final option is the one that, that the Heritage Foundation has been an advocate of, which we call the protect and defend strategy. There, a mix of offensive and defensive forces are brought to bear in order to provide the flexibility and responsive capabilities, hopefully based on the central principle of non-aggression, to achieve the stability outcomes that you would prefer, first and foremost, crisis stability. As you can see from the chart, if the United States pursues simultaneously, which I think is what this administration is doing, nuclear disarmament at a time that the nonproliferation problem is getting worse. Not only did you not have many reductions in nuclear weapons, even though the U.S. equivalent, what's not apparent from that chart, is the U.S. equivalent player reduced his numbers dramatically, at least in terms of his commitment to do so, but that this nonproliferation problem led to a crisis instability outcome, even though that wasn't the object of the game that ended in a nuclear exchange. That negated their ability to do a quantitative analysis on reductions, because unless you were to count reductions being an arms control achievement because the reductions were achieved through the use of the weapons in war, it came to a partial null outcome. On the second choice, which is to preserve retaliatory deterrence capacity, you didn't have a nuclear exchange. You could say that you got some modicum of stability outcome, at least compared to the first option, but you sure didn't reduce the numbers. In fact, the dynamic is such that it would be very predictable. If it's all about nuclear deterrence in the multipolar setting, all the players are going to race to achieve the highest level of armaments possible within their resource limitations. And that's exactly what happened in the second iteration of this game, as we call it. The final one, which mixes offensive and defensive forces, which would allow defensive to play a greater role and tamp down the aggressive impulses of any of the nuclear-armed players, you find that it leaves you more room for reductions. Now, some of those could be achieved through arms control arrangements, and indeed one of the elements in this was a U.S.-Russian arms control deal. Also by the fact that you've got some other non-nuclear element competing for the resources of defense dollars that naturally led the players in that direction. But look at what happened in that third option. That didn't materialize until about round three or four. And we're clearly in round one, as I see it now, with regard to Obama administration arms control and disarmament policies. So I think that we need to step back, take stock, and focus on what we can really do to establish the foundation for stable outcomes. And starting again, most importantly, with crisis stability, our greatest goal should be to make sure that these weapons are not used. And that is not necessarily compatible with an immediate rush to some arbitrary number in terms of reductions. I want a rationale for that. I want to be convinced that the overall approach with regard to issues like modernization, declaratory policy, arms control and disarmament, and nonproliferation policy are all in sync in reinforcing each other in terms of particularly that central goal of preventing or reducing the likelihood of the use of nuclear weapons.
Okay. We'll start with the affirmative side. We'll ask the negative side three questions, and then vice versa when that's done.
Do you want to do those one at a time?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Baker, you talked about stepping back and taking stock. The previous START agreement expired in December of 2009. So it seems to me we have a choice between no treaty or a treaty with reductions. Under those circumstances, you choose no treaty and no reductions. Is that correct?
Not exactly. Now, do you want me to explain now?
Sure.
Well, one thing is that it is true that START has expired, but it doesn't mean that the Moscow Treaty has expired. And the United States and Russia are under a legal obligation to continue their reductions. In fact, they've largely been met, of course. But keep on that track until that treaty expires. Was it 2013? End of 2012, I thought. End of 2012. And in the interim, what we had suggested at Heritage is that you adopt a verification and transparency protocol to the Moscow Treaty. We think that that would have been a better approach. It's true that it didn't mean that there would be an additional increment of reductions, as is being discussed in the current negotiations. But as far as I'm concerned, if you look at the history of the last 10 years, the number of at least operationally deployed strategic nuclear warheads has indeed come down. And so I don't think that we're on the wrong track as it relates to nuclear arms restraint. You could say that you might want to adopt a more aggressive track. I don't agree with that. But I think that that would have been a more appropriate approach.
Would have been, but it's too late for that. Now, you don't endorse aggressive. You don't endorse aggressive reductions. As I understand these negotiations that are underway, the numbers will move down of deploy strategic nuclear weapons from 1,700 to 2,200 under the Treaty of Moscow to 1,600 under this likely agreement we don't know yet under the new START agreement. Is this too aggressive for you?
It is more so, though, with regard to delivery vehicles than it is with regard to warhead numbers.
Delivery vehicles, which might be reduced to, I think it's 800 or so?
Yeah, it's 700, 800, probably something like that.
But, again, it's not a major reduction compared to what the United States has now, is it?
Not dramatic, but the implications of it could be, because it might drive you, for example, to abandon the triad. It might cause you, if particularly you're interested in demerving, to get on the wrong track with what will incentivize the Russians, in my judgment, to go to more multiple warhead delivery vehicles. And so I think that there are specific dangers in that that are greater than just the number, the increment of reductions in the number of delivery vehicles.
I thought the Bush administration didn't care about if the Russians deploying multiple warhead missiles. START 2, START 3 would have dealt with these, but those agreements weren't completed, so the Bush administration produced a new agreement, but they said however the Russians want to deploy the missiles, they can. One warhead, several warheads, it doesn't matter. You have a different point of view then.
I have a slightly different point of view on that, yes.
I guess that's three by my count.
Okay.
I can come up with others.
My first question is one that's really at the core, I think, of the debate here, which is that is there any rationale? Is there any political or military utility to nuclear weapons? In short, is there any circumstance which you would determine that the U.S. Should or would be justified in using these weapons?
I believe there is a reason to have a nuclear weapons force, and that's to serve as a deterrent against a nuclear attack, against a nuclear attack of the against the United States. I think it's not surprising that since 1945, when nuclear weapons were first developed and two used, the United States has been involved in a lot of conflicts since that time, and so has the Soviet Union, Russia. And yet nuclear weapons have not been used. And the reason why is nuclear weapons have a purpose, at least to deter a nuclear attack, but are not very not usable as a weapon of war. And under the circumstances, I think it makes great sense to substantially reduce nuclear weapons. Again, nuclear weapons should serve as a deterrent, so if a country were to use them against the United States, we would have we could use them in return. That's the only circumstance in which I would see nuclear weapons to be used.
I'm going to pick up on the word only, because that's the course of my concern. I believe that if that is the sole purpose of nuclear weapons, in this case in the hands of the U.S. military, is to deter a nuclear strike, then you have what I would describe as a transparent bluff. If the sole purpose is to deter an attack occurs on the United States nonetheless, then the sole purpose for having the weapons will have disappeared.
And your point?
My point is that it's a bluff. If you believe that their only purpose is deterrence, and it has no connection on whether these weapons have to fulfill some sort of political or military mission beyond that, then under the hypothetical circumstances that I just posed, you wouldn't use the weapons.
You can't say that. You don't know what a U.S. leader would do were he or she to see thousands of nuclear warheads, hundreds of nuclear warheads, five nuclear warheads headed against American cities. It's an unknowable question. You call it a bluff. I would say it's an unknowable question. The only time the two countries actually came very close to using nuclear weapons was in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And fortunately, U.S. and the Soviet Union resisted at that point. You call it a bluff. I call it a deterrent, a successful deterrent policy that has worked for more than 60 years. And if you want, if it's a bluff, it's certainly been a very successful bluff since 1945.
I have a different view on the history of that, but let's go to the final question within this logic train, though, is that what is it then in that deterrence policy that will lead you to pick any specific number of weapons that should be in the U.S. arsenal? If that is the policy, how do you arrive on an informed basis at the specific number that you would endorse as being the rational target in the arms control negotiations today, or maybe even follow-ons beyond the agreement that the administration is negotiating now?
Well, unfortunately, the Obama administration did not let me pick the numbers in this agreement, but they had a process established with the Joint Chiefs involved, the civilian military and the Department of Energy and Department of State, and is all part of the nuclear posture review, which has not been completed, but the part relevant to what kind of numbers we could negotiate as part of this New START agreement were agreed upon. There is a rationale for the numbers. It is contained in that part of the nuclear posture review that has been completed and endorsed by the nations and military leaders. They are saying this limit of, I guess it's 1,500 to 1,675 nuclear warheads is a defensible number, is a rational number, is a number that easily would defend the United States of America. I would go further and go much below that, but that they didn't ask me.
Okay. I'll start with a question for Baker. Picking up sort of on two different statements that were made, your fundamental premise, or one of, was that the times that we need in a nuclear multipolar world, we should not foreclose options via reductions. But picking up on sort of the question that John asked with regards to numbers, the relatively modest reductions, or phrased as such by some, that are occurring within the START Treaty, how do those specifically foreclose U.S. crisis stability options with other powers in a crisis stability scenario where the U.S. will still probably have the overwhelming conventional superiority and probably a great deal more of nuclear weapons as well?
When we did this same exercises in a crisis stability mode, we did have nuclear exchanges, and there was no doubt that those were under the circumstances where the U.S. had a significant numerical advantage over every other one of the players. This happened to be in an East Asian abstract setting, other than, as is the case today, Russia. Why did there happen to be nuclear exchanges that resulted in that? It wasn't so much necessarily the numbers alone. It had to do with the dynamic that was the interplay between what I would describe as the lesser, meaning numerical lesser, nuclear powers and the great one and the relatively stronger nuclear powers. In one instance, let me just use an example, is there was a focus in this East Asian setting on trying to resolve the problem that existed in the real world on what in the abstract setting was the equivalent of the Korean Peninsula setting. The problem with it was, as all the players were focused on that, the China-Taiwan dynamic was spinning out of control. And it's not something that would have been as much of there was not during the Cold War the kind of space that would allow you, political space, they wouldn't have either the Russia or the United States or both essentially try to wind down any potential direct conflict resulting from that. Nonetheless, particularly in a circumstance where retaliatory deterrence postures were the order of the day, which was what was the assumption in this particular setting, we did have an exchange. So I think that there's a lot of things that go on with regard to the dynamic here, of which admittedly numbers is only one, but still the conceptual difference, I think, is, to put it crudely, is that if the Cold War dynamic of two scorpions in a bottle worked, the world that we're facing today, perhaps, and with a pretty good probability tomorrow, is more like six or seven scorpions in a bottle, that the dynamic's different. How do you deal with a with a sharp departure with regard to the coalition dynamic among nuclear armed states. What if it's what if it starts out as a 4-on-3 coalition setting and it suddenly changes to 6-on-1? Those are the kinds of things that I think that we need to build flexibility, not the kind of death grip retaliatory deterrence policies that we had during the Cold War, into the system, because that kind of brittleness in terms of your strategic posture, including for nuclear weapons, won't be flexible enough to adjust to those circumstances.
There's also a follow-up question to that. Why is it a high number of strategically deployed weapons is critical to this offense-defense mix, in that the current treaty, it seems to appear, will not restrict missile defense in any super meaningful way. And the administration has shown support, albeit perhaps not as strong as some would like, for missile defense. So it seems that within the confines of still a fairly robust, pretty robust number of strategic deployed weapons and support for missile defense, why can that balance not be found with the approach the current administration is taking?
First of all, I think that it's important to point out that you can have limitations on options for the United States that are not embedded in the text of the treaty through what we call linkages. I believe that the administration's cancellation of the third site in Europe was just such a linkage. They wanted to reset relations with Russia in order to improve the chances for this particular negotiation to succeed, so you had a linkage that resulted in an immediate and tangible reduction in terms of a U.S. missile defense option, one that the previous administration had proposed, obviously, for deployment in Europe. Now, in the greater scheme of things, could you come up with an offense-defense mix that would result on the basis of other postures, strategic postures in the world, among allies and friends, as well as potential adversaries and enemies, that could lead you to numbers like the administration is looking at, both near-term and long-term? Maybe. But I think that that's jumping to conclusions. It's essentially going on the basis of an educated guess as opposed to doing the detailed analysis that's required to support the determination of the number that you need. So I am reluctant at this particular point in time to move towards lower numbers, particularly in the absence of modernization for the nuclear force, which I think has been in atrophy for about a decade or more, until we understand where we want to go with that offense-defense mix.
It's actually transitioning to Mr. Isaacs was the question I wanted to ask him. Your remarks centered on the strong bipartisan support for reductions with Russia. Those reductions are usually also followed up with a statement that says something about, and they need to be safe, secure, and effective. There was linkage language in the Defense Authorization Act about maintaining the complex and the warheads and the delivery systems, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to me the administration has started to answer this question, but certainly not fully. How does the administration, both politically and substantively, tackle maintaining a strong deterrent while we seek these reductions?
I think the Obama administration has tackled that issue very effectively and has been assisted by an independent report of the JASINs on our nuclear weapons stockpile. Firstly, the JASINs report, these are scientists, experts on nuclear weapons issues, studied the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile to see if it was, as Baker Springs said, atrophying. It's old and decrepit. I may be, but the JASINs report did not say that about nuclear weapons. It said they found no evidence that the accumulation of changes incurred from aging and life extension programs have increased risk to the certification of today's deployed nuclear warheads. And I might point out that for 10 years, the Secretaries of Defense and Secretaries of Energy have certified that our nuclear weapons stockpile is safe, effective, and reliable. The JASINs further concluded lifetime of today's nuclear warheads could be extended for decades with no anticipated loss of confidence. With no anticipated loss of confidence by using approaches similar to those employed in life extension programs today. Moreover, the Obama administration is clearly very cognizant of this problem, both political and substantive, perhaps. It has come up with a budget that increases spending on nuclear weapons by about 10% from last year's budget, much to the discomfort of many people in my community, but is increasing spending to ensure that the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile remains safe, reliable, and effective. Moreover, you had the op-ed piece written by Vice President Biden about 2 weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal, again affirming that position, that the U.S. will maintain an adequate, safe, effective, and reliable deterrence. This is not an atrophying nuclear force. This is the most powerful nuclear force that exists today, and I don't think it's one that anybody, including I don't think Baker Spring, would want to trade with anyone, whether it's the Russians, the Chinese, or anyone else.
Sort of coming at arms control from a different perspective, perhaps a little bit, some of the reasons you provided for supporting reductions in the arsenal are that in the sort of perhaps different view of the 21st century, the risk of terrorism, theft, et cetera, are now reasons why 23,000 is a very daunting number to us. But my question is, how valuable is arms control, bilateral U.S.-Russian arms control in that process? Because it seems to me that these reductions, as you pointed out, will be fairly modest. They've taken a while, and arms control has turned out to be no easy process, and that the threat of things like nuclear terrorism and whatnot stems probably less from U.S. and Russian strategically deployed warheads against a number of other ways that we could probably combat these type of threats perhaps easier or more effectively than arms control.
I think all steps forward to deal with nuclear terrorism and the danger of threat of nuclear weapons should be pursued, including nuclear reductions negotiated between the United States and Russia, including by a strengthened non-proliferation treaty, including by finding ways to increase verification of what countries are doing, including ways to try to deal with the problems of what Iran is pursuing and what North Korea has pursued. You say how safe, reliable, how the problem isn't U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons. Well, there actually have been problems with U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons. There have been many attempts to steal Russian nuclear weapons since the fall of communism there. Fortunately, as far as we know, all of them have been unsuccessful. But that's an important step, a good reason to start reducing U.S.-Russian nuclear weapons by greater numbers. Just last week or a few days ago, there was a story about how some anti-nuclear activists got on a base in Belgium where there are nuclear weapons stored. The U.S. has had several accidents or near accidents the last few years, including putting 6 live nuclear warheads on a plane that flew from, I think it was North Dakota to Louisiana. So there is a danger. There's a risk with the 23,000 nuclear weapons, including most of those in the hands of the United States and Russia. I admit the reductions are modest, and they should be much deeper, and I'd like to see that. But these steps should go hand in hand with, for example, the administration's 4-year pledge to try to secure nuclear materials across the globe as another important step. As I talked about, increased verification, trying to find out what North Korea might be shipping elsewhere. But these are all series of steps that should be taken, including the nuclear reductions as one of the primary steps.
All right. I think we'll move to the last each side. We'll start with the affirmative and then conclude with the negative. The closing statements.
I thought we closed after the questions.
Oh, we could do that too.
That seems to make more sense than okay. Now. You're going to have back and forth with questions.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Is that okay?
No. That's fine. Whatever you prefer.
No, but it's okay.
I think those microphones. Still. If you'd state your name and affiliation.
Richard White's Hudson Institute. One of the issues that people are considering, and Baker raises explicitly about nuclear reductions, is how third parties might react. And the particular focus is China. There's debate whether if the U.S. and Russia come down to a certain level, the Chinese will, quote-unquote, surge to parity. As an aside, we're having an event at Hudson this Thursday, which you're all invited to, from 2 to 4 o'clock, on non-proliferation in Asia. Okay, that aside, I'm interested in what the speakers think about that, because the evidence is ambiguous. So far, they haven't, but you could think of reasons why they might. So I'm interested in your assessments. Thank you.
I certainly think that if you take the U.S. and Russian arsenals down to the levels in terms of operationally deployed warheads while the Chinese are building up, you will find that there's at least a potential incentive for the Chinese to try and achieve what amounts to a parity level with with the U.S. and the Russians. Now the Chinese, so far, for whatever reason, have chosen to at least put on a facade. Maybe there's more substance to it than my skeptical mind attributes to it, but of a minimum deterrence, a minimum nuclear deterrence posture. But I'm not sure that that's going to be the case if, in fact, that they find material political benefits out of achieving parity. And I think that there is a chance that the United States and Russia could incentivize China to move in that direction.
It's fortunately, unfortunately, a question we don't have to deal with for quite a while. I mean, again, the United States and Russia have many thousands of nuclear warheads, many thousands of nuclear warheads. The Chinese have maybe 240 or 250. When we get to that point where the U.S. reductions over Baker Springs' dead body probably, when we get to that point of nuclear reductions where we get closer to the numbers that the Chinese might supposedly consider building up and racing, that's clearly a point when we have to get the other nuclear powers involved, the Chinese, the French, the British, the Pakistanis, the Indians, and so on. But that's so far away that it's really not a question. It's not a question for tonight. The question tonight is whether we should reduce nuclear weapon stockpiles, and I think that clearly the answer is yes. You're getting to a point far down the road, which would be nice to get to, but we're certainly not going to be there for a long time.
Question for Baker. David Culp with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. You supported the CERT treaty, didn't you?
The which treaty?
The Treaty of Moscow.
Yes, I did.
So I'm still trying to sort this out,
so to speak.
Use a pun. You supported that treaty, but you don't support these reductions.
I don't support them under the current policies of this administration, which are dramatically different from the policies that were being pursued by the Bush administration, in my judgment, specifically the one with regard to nuclear disarmament
at the time that the SORT treaty
was negotiated.
Tell me again, what's the difference between this administration and that administration on nuclear weapons policy?
One has a declared policy of moving to zero, a world without nuclear weapons.
Right.
That was not on the table in any material way in the younger Bush administration.
And you don't see this as a very long glide path?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think that the administration, let's take an example where I think the administration could have a very dramatic impact overnight. And I don't think that the Congress could stop it if it chose to do it as it would describe it as an essential stepping stone to nuclear disarmament, and that is what is commonly called de-alerting. If they go to a dramatic de-alerting posture, I think that that would have extraordinarily destabilizing impact. But the administration, I assume, in the Nuclear Posture Review is going to do that because the president during the campaign made an unqualified and unequivocal commitment to do so, saying that, in my judgment, wrongly, that the U.S. nuclear weapons are on hair trigger alert.
All right. And so because you think there may be de-alerting in the Nuclear Posture Review, you're opposing the START follow-on?
I think it all goes hand in hand. You've got to deal with the entire strategic posture of the United States, in my judgment, or at least with a nuclear posture, in order to make any sense of it.
Hi, Dick Klass, Colonel, U.S. Air Force, retired. I'd like to follow on to this because I think there's a little bit of nonsense being talked. The SORT treaty expires December 31st, 2012. The day it comes into force. Mm-hmm. It is a three-page, quadruple-spaced, empty vessel. It has no verification because in 2002... President Bush looked into Putin's eyes and said, we can trust this guy. We don't need verification. It is a nonsense treaty that has no practical effect and ought to be laughed off the stage. On a more serious note, as far as getting rid of all nuclear weapons, I would contend, A, that Obama has said he doesn't expect that in his lifetime, maybe not in his kids' lifetime. It's a goal like ending hunger. But if we could get rid of all nuclear weapons, would not the United States be eminently more safe? Because the only threat to the United States is nuclear weapons. Chem and bio are, yeah, they're semi-serious, but they're not of the order of magnitude of nukes. And yet the United States is the only power in the world that can conduct non-nuclear strategic war and basically paralyze any mid- and large-sized country in the world. So without nuclear weapons, U.S. military dominance, wouldn't it be larger than it is today?
Under the hypothetical circumstances that you pose, it could be, yes. But the fact of the matter is that nuclear weapons are not going to disappear just because we wish them to do so. I see, for example, that the Russians are actually becoming more dependent on nuclear weapons. And by the way, I can see the argument emerging in the near future with regard to that, that the real cause of the inability to get to, quote-unquote, lower numbers of nuclear weapons is because of U.S. conventional superiority, and so shouldn't the U.S. give up its conventional advantage in order to urge on or encourage the process for nuclear reductions? These things do tie together.
I wonder if I could just ask a follow-up. You're very concerned, Baker, about this Obama-stated policy. Mm-hmm. If the nuclear policy review that comes out roughly in 2 weeks mm-hmm. does not endorse de-alerting, does not endorse zero nuclear weapons, does endorse modest reductions as seem to be the likely target in these negotiations with Russia, would you therefore decide maybe you could endorse reductions in nuclear weapons at this point?
I'd have to see the specifics of what else went along with that other than the ones that you posit. But I've seen no evidence that the administration has any intention of abandoning its clear commitment, going back to the Prague speech, of a world without nuclear weapons. It is at the cornerstone, in my judgment, of the administration's declared policy. And that includes in the Biden op-ed of just a couple weeks ago. So I don't think that the posit is very likely to happen.
Leonore Tamara with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Mm-hmm. And I had a question for Baker Spring. Following on your stated argument that you're against the use or preventing the use of nuclear weapons, but also against further reductions in the U.S. Arsenal. And so my question is, how do you square preventing the use or lowering the risk that nuclear weapons would be used with the possibility of unauthorized or miscalculation on the part of Russia? And so how do you square maintaining the levels of nuclear weapons on U.S. and Russian, both Russian and U.S. sides, with lowering the possibility that these weapons might be used in error?
There's two answers to that question. One's sort of near term, the other is longer term. The near-term one is that if you believe in the effectiveness of nuclear deterrence, at least by the evidence that was presented during the circumstantial evidence presented during the Cold War, where the numbers went up pretty dramatically from about the mid-years of the Cold War, late 60s, early 70s, until the end of the Cold War in the 1990s, we did not have an exchange. So that for those that are the devotees of what I would describe as retaliation-based deterrence policy, it can be fairly tolerant with regard to numbers of weapons. In fact, some would argue that larger numbers of weapons actually reinforces the deterrent psychology. I'm not a particularly strong advocate of that school, but I think that you could make that argument plausibly. The longer-term answer, and the one that's more appealing to me, is what we've referred to here in this gaming exercise as the protect and defend strategy. That is trying to encourage through the arms control process and other means more fundamentally defensive strategic postures as opposed to the ones that are associated with retaliation-based deterrence. And what do I mean by that? In my judgment, I think that it is possible for the United States and those that are nuclear armed states that are willing to go down this road is to say, well, if you have nuclear weapons, that, for to put it bluntly, are you know, slow, dumb, and dirty, clearly meant to go after only civilian or other so-called soft targets, that those are the kinds of things we really ought to set aside. But if you have an overall strategic posture with some mix of offensive and defensive forces that can clearly be designed to defend your own people, territory, institutions, and infrastructure, then maybe we got something we can go on there. But we haven't done even the beginnings of the foundation for putting that particular kind of thing in place on a knowledgeable basis. And I think we ought to go about doing that and getting that foundation set. And so that's what I argue for the long run.
Hi, I'm Mary Slauson from the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation.
Mm-hmm.
We are live tweeting this for our Nukes of Hazzard readers. And we ask them if they had any questions. One of them does. Many of them do. Plutonium Page wants to know, Baker Spring, if you support the first use of a nuclear weapon, and if so, under what circumstances?
I would not rule it out, certainly. I would not endorse a no first use policy. I think that it would have to be a very high threshold. It would have to be something where you would be using the weapon as perhaps the only, almost certainly the only means to reliably destroy a means of attack on the United States, a strategic means of attack on the United States that would result in large-scale loss of life and damage, very large scale. But to me, that would be the most obvious case. And it does go hand-in-hand on the tactical level off on the offensive side with what would more fundamentally be a defensive policy. So if let's take an example where we don't have defenses in place, and the only means that I had to go after a very hardened means of delivery that there was a very good likelihood of being used against the United States with a nuclear warhead on it, if that was my only option, then yes, that's what I would do in order to try to defend the people of the United States and, for that matter, our allies that may be subject to the same kind of threat.
My question is for John. I try to mix it up a little bit. I'm Heather Williams from the Institute for Defense Analyses. You've mentioned verification quite a few times, and we've seen this as the major sticking point in the START Renewal Treaty. No arms control treaty is going to be 100% verifiable. So what verification measures would you suggest for the U.S. to pursue in order to avoid unilateral disarmament? And also, as we further decrease our arsenals, verification is going to become increasingly difficult. Would you still support further and deeper arms reductions if verification became more questionable?
Verification is actually a series of things. Partly it's the agreements that will be contained in a treaty, but an awful lot of verification is done through national technical means, spy satellites and the rest. At this point, the United States of America has very strong ideas, clear conception of what Russia is doing, what China is doing, India and Pakistan. Not infallible, but still pretty good. What a treaty does, a negotiated treaty, as opposed to a situation where we'd have no START treaty and nothing but a three-page treaty that with nothing very clear about it, the treaty would set limits, and it's a way to judge what Russia is doing and the Russians to judge what we're doing, so we don't have to assume, well, this is a limit of 1,600 warheads, but maybe they're building 1,800 or building 2,200. So you get a whole series of things. You get limits that you can use as a basis for verification. You get verification procedures where there's some exchange of data. I obviously don't know how much there will be in the new START agreement because the text is not available. You'll have natural technical means, a whole series of ways for the United States to be sure of what Russia is doing. And there's a great quote, I'd have to pull it out here, but from Senator Richard Lugar, the ranking Republican Foreign Relations Committee, and said, yeah, you can quibble, and there are some things that we don't like what the Russians done, the Russians don't like what we've done, but by and large, verification has been extremely effective in START 1, that there have been something like 600 inspections and so on, and we have that treaty that has now expired provided a basis for judging what Russia is doing and for the Russians to verify what we're doing. There will be clearly another series of verification procedures and limits in the new agreement. Again, I don't know the details. That will help U.S. intelligence and U.S. military knowing more precisely what Russia is up to. And even without a treaty with China, Iran, all the other countries, again, we have a pretty good idea what they're doing.
Just ask one quick follow-up. If you rely on those verification means, but you do find out that there is a possibility that Russia is not in compliance, what's next? We've seen this with the CTBT. The Strategic Posture Commission noted that there is evidence suggesting that Russia is conducting low-yield testing. I realize CTBT is a different issue. I just kind of wanted to get a follow-up.
We'll call that a red herring for the moment. Yeah. Again, by and large, the Russians and the United States have lived up to the treaties. If there's a material breach, if there's a great cheating that goes on, then there are obvious steps you can take, including jump out of the treaty, for example. But by and large, the whole history of nuclear arms control agreements from Ronald Reagan to George Herbert Walker Bush to the other agreements, the agreements have served effectively to help the intelligence agencies on each side to know what the other is doing. And there have been some quibbling around the edges about what the Russians have done. The Russians quibble around the edges of what we've done. But by and large, both countries have lived up to those agreements. And I'll leave it at that.
I think we'll take, if we can rope two questions together, we'll take those and we'll do concluding statements and then drink the rest of the beer.
I'm up for that. Is this on? Okay. Drew Walter, Sandia National Laboratories. I'll ask a slightly parochial question. Actually, I have two questions. One is for both of you. How does flexibility in the stockpile versus flexibility in the underlying supporting infrastructure play into your concepts of how reductions could occur? Is it are the timescales too short in either of your minds to have flexible infrastructure provide some of that flexibility and crisis stability? And then a question specifically for Mr. Spring. Under your concept, how would you design and size the stockpile? Where do you draw that line between something that is of such low probability, perhaps a very high consequence, that it really isn't a factor in nuclear policy considerations?
If I can start first and just plead ignorance, I don't know what the heck flexible infrastructure is, so I can't really respond. If you can explain it in about 15 words that even I could understand, I'd be glad to respond, but maybe Baker has a better sense of it.
Well, I mean, obviously, I do share some of the from an outside observer of the nuclear weapons enterprise, that what is responsible or flexible in the views of one person may not be so in the views of the others, particularly those operating within the system, who probably see the weaknesses from inside better than we do from the outside. As it relates to the what is necessary with regard to the flexibility, I think it's going to, and I'm going to address this in my closing remark, it all comes back down to the term of what, of the word that the president uses when he says he wants an effective arsenal. Well, what does effective mean? It's not self-evident. It's not a self-defining word, certainly not in this context, and I think that we have to look at that. As it relates to how would I arrive at a number that's not arbitrary under my protect and defend strategy, I think that's what you're asking. To my mind, that all comes down to targeting in terms of the active arsenal. And then what would happen with regard to the stockpile and the nuclear weapons infrastructure would, of course, flow from that as to what you need in terms of both the quality and the quantity within meeting those targeting requirements. Now, how would I define that? What I'd basically say is that I'd want a total strategic posture that would, to the greatest extent possible, hold at risk the means of strategic attack on the United States and its allies. I think that that target set is properly divided into three baskets with appropriate level of redundancy, one basket being effectively non-nuclear defensive systems, missile defenses, air defenses, counterterrorism defenses, all the things that we would talk about with regard to the defensive element. The other is conventional strike capabilities, including ones that we would apply under the moniker prompt global strike. And then the final would be, of course, those things that are within the nuclear arsenal. And what I would do is I would look at that target set and say, well, which basket does this particular target most appropriately fall in? And where would the redundancy come in? The redundancy would come in when the same target may be in two separate baskets at different stages. For example, a ballistic missile on a launch pad, relatively unprotected, would be subject, one presumes, to at least potentially a prompt global strike option. But once it's launched, then it's going to be within the province of the defenses. So once you've built that target set and divided it up accordingly, then I think that it flows pretty logically as to what you need with regard to the stockpile and the weapons infrastructure for that element that applies within the nuclear deterrent.
I'd have to say a lot of this, as described earlier by Baker Spring and this response to the question, it just does smack me of a nuclear war games that people all used to debate during the Cold War, rungs of escalation. Herman Kahn from Hudson Institute, and for example, was famous for that. And I think most of these theories wound up being justification to build huge numbers of nuclear weapons far beyond what we need and were nonsensical scenarios that would only wind up destroying the United States, the Soviet Union, and most people on this earth. And the currently people now more widely accept the fact that all these scenarios of nuclear war and, oh, we'll hit these 10 targets or these 15 targets or these war games are really scenarios for perhaps destroying the human race. And that's why I believe there is that consensus that I describe. Not as far as I would go, of course, but the Kissinger, the Schultz, the Schlesinger, that both the United States and Soviet Union, Russia, built far more nuclear weapons than we'd ever need. That the United States and Russia could easily reduce nuclear weapons by, as they say, a modest number, without any harm to United States security, probably enhancing security by reducing the number of targets for terrorists. If you play these war games and go through all the scenarios, you can wind up having justification for 1,000, 1,700, 2,200, 5,000, 10,000 nuclear warheads, and that's what the United States and the Soviet Union did during the Cold War. I think that that is, again, a formula for massive destruction that the political leaders of this country, the presidents of the United States, and fortunately the Soviet prime ministers and presidents decided was a terrible mistake. The nuclear weapons have a purpose, and that's to deter attack against us, to keep the conflicts that were breaking out between the two countries in hand without resorting to nuclear weapons. But if you start using those scenarios and deciding there are all sorts of uses of nuclear weapons and dreaming up new targets for nuclear warheads, which happened over and over during the Cold War, then you wind up building huge, unnecessary numbers of nuclear weapons. I think, again, the political consensus is we're in a different world now. Whether it was right or wrong then, it doesn't matter. Now we're in a different world. We can reduce nuclear weapons and still quite easily preserve U.S. security.
This is the nub of the problem. In my judgment, first of all, that it's wrong to state that the United States had anything during the Cold War that I would associate with what would be in the parlance that Heritage uses, a protect and defend strategy. It was about retaliation-based deterrence. It was about making nuclear weapons the cornerstone of strategic stability in the concepts put forth by Thomas Schelling. Now, you can make an argument, certainly one that history probably looks favorably on, although I think to a certain degree there were risks associated with it that that I don't think fortunately came to the surface, but that we're really about preventing general warfare by focusing on the destructive capability of nuclear weapons and therefore making nuclear weapons the coin of the realm in terms of the strategic relationship at that point between the United States and the then Soviet Union. All I can say with regard to whether you, at the end of the day, if you go down the path of the protect and defend strategy that I advocate, will be more or fewer nuclear weapons, all I can say is that in the exercises that we've conducted, now just two of them admittedly, so it's early in the process, that with a defensive-oriented policy, we were able to demonstrate that we ended up with fewer. Now, is that a foregone conclusion under all circumstances with different players playing slightly different variations of the game? Maybe not. But certainly it does show to me that it's not inevitable, because you go through the process of gaming these things out, that you inevitably wind up with greater numbers of nuclear weapons rather than fewer. Finally saying, putting that all into context, I don't think it's wise to say that the most important element in the question about the future of nuclear weapons is the numbers per se. That is that those numbers have a circumstance. They exist in a context. And to ignore the context and focus sort of single-mindedly on numbers is, you know, 1,000 is better than 1,500 under any conceivable circumstance. I just don't think that's right.
Last question.
But did he have a part B that he never got to ask? It's all right.
Okay. Hello, Mr. Spring. Tad Daly is my name. I'm with International Physicians Preventing Nuclear War. Mm-hmm. But pretend, please, for the moment that I am not. Pretend that I am a government official, indeed a defense planner, for the state of Syria or Indonesia or Venezuela. And Mr. Spring, I am completely convinced you have made an unanswerable case that your country, despite your overwhelming conventional military power and indeed conventional military superiority over any possible set of adversaries, cannot protect your national security without thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons. So I think that my country really needs to get some of our own. In fact, I'm going to go back to my office right now and get busy on a memo to my president convincing him that we need to get busy acquiring or producing a nuclear arsenal of our own. Please persuade me that my country can protect our national security without any nuclear weapons, even though your country apparently cannot.
And I think that the answer to that question again comes within context. If the concern of Syria or Venezuela is that the United States, out of the blue, is going to attack them with nuclear weapons, I think that history provides a pretty persuasive case that the United States in the past has not done that and will likely not do that in the future. I would also say that that one of the reasons why I want to move to a more defensive strategic posture is precisely to acknowledge that for any country, as much as I may disagree with their internal circumstances and structure, I'm not a fan of North Korea by any stretch, but I acknowledge that even a country like North Korea has a legitimate right to self-defense, embodied in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, if nowhere else. So that if North Korea decides that that it needs to take step X, Y, or Z that is genuinely defensive, I'm not likely to have that much of a problem with it. Indeed, one of the things that I would do under my policy in order to encourage those kinds of defensive stance, including with Russia, is to find greater ways to cooperate, specifically in questions related to strategic defenses. And so that if we can embed this in the principle of non-aggression, I think that that ultimately is the answer over, for to put it crudely, adopting a policy of multilateral mutual assured destruction.
I think we found another area of agreement. I'm not a fan of North Korea either.
All right. Time for the closing statements. We'll start with the affirmative and then close it up with the negative.
Okay, thank you, Clark Murdoch, who doesn't, I don't know if he's still here. Oh, there he is. He keeps moving around. Mm-hmm. And Chris, for inviting me tonight. I hope it's been a useful debate. I hope everyone's been convinced of my position, of course. I have to commend people for asking questions and, by and large, asking questions instead of giving long statements and then saying, do you agree? Which is frequently happens at some of these sessions. And I hope people will Google the question and find a pony what that means. I think the case for nuclear reductions is quite apparent, as I've stated before, that in the real world of today, the post 9/11 world of proliferation of threats of terrorists, we can safely and significantly reduce nuclear arsenals. There are a series of war games, two out of three, I guess, of which have been completed, but the real-world policymakers say, their war games say it's time to reduce nuclear weapons, that Schlesinger and Shultz and Kissinger and Perry and Nunn and Baker and so many others, Perry, have said, those war games may once have made sense, but we're in a different world, and we can reduce nuclear weapons significantly, and that in a way that would enhance U.S. security and deal with the new threats we face, as opposed to the threats we faced during the Cold War. I think it's important to note again that the treaty that is currently being negotiated and hopefully one day will be concluded will provide important limits and important verification procedures. That the alternative to these limits and verification procedures is no treaty except the Treaty of Moscow, which is not much of a treaty. A new nuclear reductions treaty will, again, help the United States better cope with the current threats it faces, reducing the threat, again, of theft of weapons or nuclear materials. And for all these reasons, I think further nuclear reductions are very much in the national security interest of the United States. Thank you.
Another increment of nuclear weapons reductions, perhaps, not now, not under current circumstances, not under reasonably predictable future circumstances, not under the declared policies of the Obama administration. What I'd like to do is come back as it relates to the nuclear posture in particular is this word effective. To me, having an effective arsenal means that nuclear arsenal means that you recognize that nuclear weapons have political and military utility to the security of the country. And if they do have that political and military utility, then you will design them, you will maintain a stockpile and an infrastructure to back them up to meet those purposes. The problem that I find with the Obama administration is that its declared policy of nuclear disarmament makes it virtually impossible to define what effective means, because what they're really pretending to do is to assert, without saying so explicitly, that nuclear weapons indeed have no political or military utility. That is why we can get rid of them. That, to me, is a wrong-headed approach. It's a wrong-headed approach with regard to lessening the likelihood that these weapons would be used. I think it's a wrong-headed approach with regard to coming up with a logical answer as to why you would have any particular number of nuclear weapons, whether it be both in the deployed arsenal and in the stockpile. And if so, what would be the purpose? To me, the purpose of any weapon in the United States, first and foremost, but particularly for those that are in the strategic posture of the United States, and the vast majority today of nuclear weapons are for strategic purposes, would be to protect and defend the people, territory, institutions, and infrastructure of this country, and through the process of our alliance structure, those of our allies. I think that that can be done. I don't think that we have done the spade work necessary to make that happen. I think that the fact that we have lost our way with regard to the purpose of our nuclear posture is reflective in the description, including from Vice President Biden in his recent op-ed, that there has been neglect. Well, that neglect just didn't happen. It's because I don't think that we've thought about these issues as carefully as we should. Do I think in the long run that once we have a clear purpose and definition about what an effective nuclear arsenal would be, that we can go to reduced numbers? Perhaps. Maybe even likely. Certainly the gaming exercise that we undertook at Heritage showed that that very easily could be the case. But the idea that we can just atrophy the nuclear force out of existence on the basis of this hope and expectation, a desire and wish really, but as a hope and expectation, that indeed these weapons don't really have any political or military utility, in my judgment, is a fool's errand.
Great. Everyone, join me in thanking both debaters. Two matters of housekeeping. We've got clocks to celebrate the ability of the debaters to stay surprisingly on time as a token of ponies' appreciation. And as Clark mentioned, the next Pony Debates Issues event will be the 2nd of March, discussing the nuclear posture reviews. So we hope that you'll join us then.